Thank you so much, Barbara, for joining us. I really appreciate your time. As we start this conversation, the first thing I want to ask you is, you, of course, are our 2022 Appalachian Heritage Writer in Residence here at Shepherd University. The first question I want to ask you is just, what has that experience been like for you? You were here in West Virginia for a week. What was that like?
It was really warm and welcoming. This is a part of West Virginia I've never visited before, to be honest. It's a part of West Virginia I didn't even know about, in the same way that I'm from a part of Virginia, Southwest Virginia, 200 miles west of Roanoke, that a lot of Virginians don't know much about. So, you know, this was a cultural experience for me to come down from the mountains into the sort of the eastern section of the state. I still, of course, found it very Appalachian because of the subject of this conference and the people who participated. And it was a great chance for me, you know, to meet people with fellow concerns about the world and about writing.
And Barbara, I want to ask you now, this is sort of a bigger picture question. What does it mean to be an Appalachian in your own experiences, in your own words?
To me, it means home. It means recognizing and celebrating my own people. I grew up in the eastern part of Kentucky. I left my little rural town, as young people do, kicking the little town dust off my shoes, going out to meet the world. And I did. I lived all over the place on several continents doing, you know, low-paying jobs. And as I traveled the world and this country especially, I encountered a lot of shocking stereotypes, a lot of condescension. Appalachians are caricatured in our mainstream media. If we see ourselves at all, even rural people and farmers are rarely depicted honestly, you know, with nuance in our mainstream media, because it's mostly made in cities by city people who don't know us. So that made me mad. It still makes me mad. After trying out a lot of different places, I came back home to Appalachia. I now live on the other side of the mountains in Southwest Virginia, but it's the same culture. It's the same language. It's the same emphasis on community and resourcefulness and kindness that I grew up knowing and loving. So as a writer, I see it as sort of my mission to represent us in a way that is seldom seen and seldom understood outside of Appalachia, to recognize the complexity of our culture. Yes, the problems we have, having, you know, our region been treated essentially like an internal colony of the United States for a couple of centuries, lots of outside corporations coming in and just mining, literally mining, taking out the good stuff and leaving behind a mess. We have problems. We have challenges. They are not our fault. But I see it as really important for me as an Appalachian writer to reflect those challenges in a bigger context, and also to write about the beauty of our place and the resilience and beauty of our culture.
That's wonderful. And, you know, as you've been writing and you're working towards this mission, do you feel as though you're meeting that mission? Do you feel like when you get feedback from people outside of Appalachia or inside Appalachia, do you find that they respond positively once you've been able to expose them to that mission that you have?
I really do. It's been really validating for people to do a double take and start to understand the depth, the nuance of our culture. Even insiders sometimes are surprised by what they find in my work, because we ourselves are so accustomed to the condescension, we start to believe it ourselves.
Barbara, I want to take us back to early on in your career. You know, for listeners who are just learning about you in this conversation, you know, your first book, The Bean Trees, I understand you wrote while you were pregnant with your first daughter. What was it about that time of your life and soon to be a mother? Why did you decide to become a novelist?
I don't know that I ever decided to become a novelist or even to become a writer. I just always wrote from childhood. I always wrote poems and stories. I was and am an insatiable reader, and a writer is just what I do. So, you know, I always planned to do something else for a living because I didn't know that people would pay me to be a writer, that they would actually buy books that I wrote. So I was really not very conscious at all of the possibility other people would read this novel that I was writing during my pregnancy. It was just kind of a natural outgrowth of writing I'd been doing. I had moved to Tucson, Arizona at that time, and I was pregnant, as you mentioned, and I had terrible insomnia, as pregnant women often do. And so for the first time in my life, I found sort of extra hours in my night after my day job was done. I had extra hours, and I thought, this is my chance. I'm going to pull all these short stories I've been working on and thinking about into a novel called The Bean Trees. And it's set in Tucson, but it's narrated by a Kentuckian. It was the first time I found my Kentucky voice that I had been trying to hide, trying to sort of put under a bushel, but put my light under a bushel because people made fun of the way I talked. So I had just reached a point in my life where I was embracing that Kentucky voice. I created that narrator who came from the mountains of Kentucky and set her loose on this story. And as my pregnant belly grew larger and larger, my thoughts about motherhood became larger and larger. And so they really did take over the plot of this book, because it's about a young woman who finds a baby in her car and for surprising reasons ends up taking it and raising this child. So that's sort of what was happening to me, even though I didn't find my baby in a car. It was more deliberate and a lot more work than that to make her. But, you know, those huge thoughts about what does it mean to take responsibility for another person's life, those were very large questions in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I finished the novel the day before I had the baby. Well, no, that's not quite true. About a week before, I sent it off to an agent in New York with no expectations at all, came home from the hospital with my baby, and learned the same day that the novel was going to be published. So my life changed in a very big way on that day.
Another time in your life when your writing sort of catapulted you into a different place in terms of recognition was your book, The Poisonwood Bible. And this book really catapulted you into the top tier of American writers and beloved writers in America. Take us back to that time of your life when that happened. That book won so many awards and accolades. And, you know, how did that impact your career as a novelist going forward to today?
I would say not really at all, not very much. You've heard a lot of recording artists say it took me 20 years to become an overnight success. That's sort of how I feel. I hadn't been writing for 20 years at that time. It was more like, I've been writing my whole life, but that was, I think, my seventh or eighth. So each one of my books reached a little bit larger audience. So I think it was my fourth one, Pigs in Heaven. It was the first of my books to appear on the New York Times bestseller list. And that event bumps you into a realm of name recognition. And then the next one did, you know, a little better. So it was, for me, it was a steady progress, but not a kind of progress I was paying much attention to, because I'm just thinking about the writing. I'm just thinking about making each book something entirely new and the best book that it can possibly be in my hands, and to write about something that really matters to me, that I think will matter to readers. So I don't pay attention to the market or sales or anything like that. I just am really happy that people buy the books and I get the royalty checks, which allow me to continue to do this for a living. I did get, you know, I started getting bigger royalty checks after The Poisonwood Bible. And so that allowed me to do some things like establishing a writer's prize, the Bellwether Prize, to direct some of that good fortune to other other places and people. So that was always good. But I don't think about prizes or you know, sales rankings or anything like that. I'm the last person on earth who wanted to be famous. I am the most introverted person you could imagine. So I'm a person who is very happy alone in a room with my desk and my keyboard and my books, and living that quiet life with my family in a quiet hollow in southwestern Virginia. That's where I'm home. I never wanted to sort of, you know, bust out on a world stage or anything like that. So it remains pretty abstract to me, except when I go on a book tour, you know, and I, you know, fly to a different city every night and talk to these, you know, enormous halls of 600 or 1,000 people who are all there because they love my books. And I look out and I say, wow, I'm not really alone in a room. I'm not talking to myself. This is a huge conversation. Thank you. I appreciate my readers. I don't mean to say they don't matter. They do matter to me, and they give me reason to go back to that quiet desk and keep doing the best work I can.
So, Barbara, you've written a lot of diverse stories, ranging from novels, short stories, poetry. Some of these stories take us all over the world. What sort of impact do your roots, your Appalachian roots, play in your writing when you write these stories, even when they take place other places, like, you know, with the Poisonwood Bible, it took place in the Congo? How does your background and roots here in Appalachia impact your writing?
You know, they say that every writer is really writing the same story over and over again. And if that's true, my story is about community. If I really examine all my works, even though they do, I work hard to make each one entirely new, not just a new place and set of characters, but asking a whole new question. I've written about climate change and why that's so hard for us to talk about. I've written, as you said, a book set in the Congo, which is about cultural arrogance and how, you know, what one nation will do to another. So these are big, big questions, sort of urgent modern themes. But if you sort of dig down into the heart of every one of these stories, it's about community. What is our duty to our community? How do we belong to it? How does it belong to us? And how does that play against the really powerful American iconography of the individual, the solo flyer, you know, the lone hero? That's supposed to be the American story. But as a woman and as an Appalachian woman, I always see like all the other people behind the solo flyer, you know, the people who gassed up his airplane, the women who packed his lunch. There is no such thing as a lone hero. I'm interested in the heroism of people who think they're ordinary and people who are helping each other, creating families for each other or safety networks for each other, who are aware of their indebtedness to their neighbors and their people. And I know that's because I come from a place where the first time you meet someone and sit down with them, the question you ask is, who are your people?
You know, you mentioned this idea about community, and earlier we talked about stereotyping and how Appalachians, they were caricatured. There's a lot of stereotypes out there when people think of Appalachia. And how important is it to you in your writing, and it sounds like, of course, it is, to convey that sense of community of Appalachia and show that kind of love and strength?
It's always a lot of fun for me to just dig into something and see what's underneath it, what's underneath that stereotype. And as I mentioned before, it's partly because our mainstream media are all manufactured in cities by city people, so it's a matter of not knowing us. But there's also this deep history, not just in this country, but globally, of nations trying to trying to push people into cities, trying to push them into the cash economy, because it works better for a government if everybody is kind of locked into the cash economy so that they pay taxes, so that they, you know, they're, you sort of can regulate them. So there's this long history of casting rural people, farmers, people out in the country as sort of the not yet there people, the people who are sort of the struggling class of people who haven't really hit the big time, you know, who haven't gained access to real life, you know, the glamorous life of cities. And city people believe it. Country people believe it. You know, it's easy for us to think we're missing out because, you know, we're out here. Well, it's about provision. It's about self-provisioning and self-reliance. A government can't tax the products that you grow and consume yourself. So if you go all the way back to the Whiskey Rebellion, Appalachians rose up when George Washington had to march in the army because they were trying to tax whiskey, and that whiskey was sort of the economy of Appalachia, and people made it something they could do with their corn that would keep and transport. And they said, you can't tax this. We're not selling it. We're consuming it. It's for our own use. So, you know, it's this fundamental sort of conflict continues. If you look at how Appalachians and, you know, hillbillies are stereotyped, you look at the farmer's straw hat, the fishing pole, the moonshine jug with the X's on it. Those are all symbols of self-reliance, farming, fishing. It's about our capacity to feed ourselves, to make our own lives separate from the, you know, the official economy that's being resisted. And when I discovered that, I thought, I need to write a whole novel that really kind of shows this history. So that's really exciting to me to kind of turn these stereotypes inside out and show where they're coming from.
You brought up another topic earlier about climate change, and I know that is an area that's really important to you. I want to ask if you can talk a little bit more about what that idea kind of plays in your writing, and also kind of think about, you know, Appalachia is known for its fossil fuels and coal mining in West Virginia, Kentucky. What role do you see Appalachia playing in this conversation we have going forward about climate change and what we're going to do about it?
Well, as a human, I'm concerned about climate change. I think as all of us are, or could be, if we had access. To good information about what's happening to the world. It's really scary, and it's true. Climate justice, human justice, these are things I think about all the time, as I think most of us do. But I'm lucky because my job is to write about whatever I want to write about. So my point of origin for a novel is always to burrow into a big question that's keeping me awake at night, and that's probably keeping other people awake at night too. And when I set out to write a novel about climate change, that's that's physics. that's geography. It's science. I was trained as a scientist, and so as a biologist. So I think about these things, but I also know that the territory of a novel is human behavior, human interaction, human transformation. So the novel that I could write about this is, why is it so hard for us to think about climate change and talk about it and even believe it's real? So I really dug into those questions in my novel, Flight Behavior, and created a plot that would really sort of explode these questions onto the stage of a little town where something catastrophic happens and, you know, half the people think it's an act of God, and then the scientists come in and say, no, it's an act of warmed air, and, you know, and then you get to have all these conversations on the page, and you make it exciting, and you make, you know, people fall in love or out of love or whatever, you know, all the things that a novelist can do to make a story interesting. So that's what I can do. That's what I can contribute to these big questions, such as, you know, how are we as Appalachians who are deeply entrenched in the fossil fuel industry, not by choice, but by companies that, you know, have a more than a century of history controlling our lives, our economy, our job opportunities. You know, the coal companies quite deliberately kept out any other industry, and they deliberately sort of suppressed the culture of education so that they could have generation after generation of people who would work in the mines willingly. So they really sort of put us in this, you know, in this kettle of fish. And now we, the people, are being blamed for our so-called backwardness because we can't move forward. This was done to us. And I think that the more people can understand this as something that was done to us, the more we as Appalachians can kind of rise up and resist and say, okay, this is not necessarily our destiny. This was, this is your problem that you put onto us, but we can solve it. I mean, Appalachians could change our culture of education. We could change our willingness and our capacity to work in other fields and provide other kinds of energy to the world, to resist this sort of calcified, ossified system that locks us into coal, which is frankly an obsolete industry. The coal companies themselves understand this.
And you mentioned flight behavior, and I want to take a moment here and just mention that flight behavior is our 2022 West Virginia Common Read. And you brought up some points you're hoping that, you know, are addressed about climate change. What are you hoping West Virginians take from your book this year as they read this novel?
I hope they will take whatever they please. That's not mine to say. I mentioned earlier that I begin a novel with a big question, something that's keeping me awake at night. And the role of literature is not to answer the big questions for you or to tell you what to think or what to do, but to invite you into a conversation, not necessarily with me, the writer, but with yourself, the reader. You know, it invites you into other people's lives where you see and feel and appreciate their problems, their perceptions, their views of the world, so that you'll come out of it having experienced something outside of yourself. And that could be any number of things because a novel has that kind of complexity. What you take from it depends on what you bring to it. If you are a person who's, let's say, in a difficult marriage, you will pay attention to the fact that Della Robbia, the protagonist of this novel, is in a difficult marriage on the verge of making some huge life choices. If you are a scientist, you will notice what the scientists are doing, and you will pay more attention to those aspects of the scientists who are struggling with the fact that they don't know how to communicate very well with ordinary people. There are all kinds of conflicts here within this novel, because a novel is that big, it's that juicy, it can have a lot of different sorts of interactions. So what part of it resonates with you, the reader, is really up to you. And that's what I love about literature. It can be many things to many people.
I understand you have a book that is soon to be hitting bookshelves on October 18th, and that is Demon Copperhead. I want to ask you to talk with us about this book, and what can readers expect when they read this?
Readers can expect a page-turner. I live in deep, deep Southwest Virginia, which is the epicenter of the opioid epidemic. So we are living with this, and I wanted for several years to write about it, and I couldn't think of a good way in that would make this story interesting and you know, appealing to people, to readers, because it's a hard subject. It's dark. It's difficult. Kids coming up in this environment. And then I sort of had a conversation with Charles Dickens, and I realized the way to tell the story is the way he told David Copperfield: let the child tell the story. That's what I realized I needed to do. So this kid, who's called Copperhead because he has red hair, he has Melungeon heritage, if people know what that is, and he's the child of a teenage drug-using mother. He's born actually on the floor of her single-wide trailer home. And he comes into the world with this fierce, if a newborn can have an attitude, demon has it. He tells you his story from his point of view, mostly taking place in his teens and early 20s as OxyContin is released into Lee County, where he lives. But he tells this story in a way that, in his own voice, in a way that will just give the reader a reason to turn every page, because you need to know how he's going to come through this, how he's going to survive, because he is a survivor. He's funny, he's fierce, and he's passionate.
And with the very little bit of time we have left, I actually want to just ask, what is next? What are you working on next? I know this book is going to be hitting shelves, but what now? What are you thinking about now for your next big project?
Well, for the immediate future, I will be on the road on a book tour. I'll be traveling the country and then actually the world. I'll be going across the ocean to talk to readers about this book and about sort of the things that matter to us all. That's, as I said earlier, the part of my job that reminds me I'm not alone in a room. I'm having a big conversation. Then I'll take that conversation back to my quiet room and I'll write another novel. I have some ideas. It's sort of cooking on the back burner, but there will be a next novel. There's always going to be a next novel. And that's the one that we as writers have to love the most. I'm also working on a screenplay. I'm doing some film work. So I'm always excited about what's coming next.
Barbara Kingsolver, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for your interest.